Thank you for being here today. At the topic, when the topics are being assigned and discussed and kind of handed out, this was one that I very passionate about, and so I actually was very excited when I got this topic. I've been working on the sermon actually for months, and this is about the longest that I've worked on a sermon in my life, I think. But I really enjoy this topic. It's something I'm very passionate about, and it'll probably come out in the next 35 minutes that we're talking this morning. As we really go through our lives, it is important to look back. I mean, we need to look back and realize what happened before us. And we have some quotes here, and you can see the George Santayana's quote that he had. That's pretty famous. There's a couple different versions of this, but this is the gist of it. That those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it. That if you don't go back and look at what happened in the past, what the decisions were made, what the consequences were, and things that happened in the past, you certainly are going to repeat the same behavior. We even see the same type of principle in the Scriptures. Paul wrote to the church in Romans there that, you know, whatever things written beforehand were written for our patience, are written for our learning, that we through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. In other words, Paul is writing that we ought to go back to the Old Testament and read those. We ought to go back and look at what happened in the Old Testament, see the decisions that were made. Look at the things that happened. God doesn't change. Those things don't change. We ought to go back and learn from that. That's a good basic concept of what we have. And so when we really take and look at our founding fathers and say, you know, the genesis of our nation, was it really based on biblical principles? Because this has certainly been under fire in the last 50 years for sure, but really under fire in the last 10 or 15 years, where we see all kinds of articles and newspapers. The founding fathers were agnostics. They were deists. And some even go as far as say they're atheists, which, you know, is really a big stretch. But anyway, we've got that type of thing that's out there. And some of our public actually believes that is starting to take hold. And some of our major newspapers, that we don't have time to go through the articles, but have some interesting takes on this. So as we really look at our own American history, we really have to go back and see what happened, what shaped the time period that we're in. Anytime you look at any period in history, you can't look at that period unless you find out what's motivating them. What's happening there? My grandfather used to take a piece of leather and would nail it to the bottom of his shoe to repair his shoe instead of going buying a new pair of shoes. Now, why would he do that? Because he remembered the Depression. He remembered what it was like to not have any money. And that shapes our thoughts. Our experiences, the things that we live through every day, shape the way we think about things. And our founding fathers were no different. If you go back into Western Europe, and most of the colonization that came to America at that time came from Western Europe, England, and some from Spain, and we have this here, and we're in this time period in history where the Bible was not readily available. We had a period of about 1,260 years that the Bible was really locked up or chained. It was chained in a couple different ways. It was chained to the pulpit, sometimes even physically, and sometimes it also was chained in a foreign language. A lot of the Bible copies at that point were in Latin. The average person on the street couldn't read Latin, and so it wasn't available to the general public. And so we've got that going, and that's going to shape a lot of what our founding fathers did. In 1517, of course, we know Martin Luther posted his 95 Theses to the church board in Wittenberg, the church in Germany, and that really got the Reformation movement into a jump start. Also in 1530, something that's going to play into the fact, we've got the Church of England splits away from the Church of Rome. The Roman Catholic Church at that time in history really controlled a lot of the religion in that particular known world. Henry VIII wanted a divorce. He couldn't get a divorce from Catherine. He wanted to marry Anne Boleyn, and you know the story. I'm summarizing a lot of history really fast. But he wants to get a divorce. He can't get a divorce, and so he starts the Church of England. Now, the Church of England was pretty much a carbon copy of the Church of Rome. It was just the king made the decision instead of the pope. And so that was really the same thing. Of course, the printing press being invented in 1440 also is by Gutenberg has a big back to play as well, because the Bible is now starting to get into society. People that never had access to the Bible are now actually able to read the Bible, actually been able to put it into a language that they can understand. And so we have what's known as a Reformation starting. And we're really, too, when we go into England in the early 1600s, in the late 1500s, we have two big movements starting to take place. People are starting to read the Bible. They're starting to look at the Bible. And you're starting to say, you know what? I'm reading the Bible, and that God doesn't always rule with kings. What is this divine right of kings thing that we have here? That doesn't make any sense. That's not really in the Bible. Because you think about it, if you lived in Western Europe in the 1500s, you might think that's the only way there is to do a government, it's king. The king rules, that's the way it's always been, and this is the mindset that they were in. But after they got access to the Bible, And they started reading the Bible and thought, you know, maybe this is not the only way to do things. Maybe there's some other ways we can take care of it. We hold it, time out, I'm reading the Bible here. We don't kill people who don't convert to Christianity. That's not the way God says to do it in the Bible. But that's the way they learned. The Crusades, the Inquisitions that happened in Western Europe in that time period of time, they started to learn these things were not right. And of course, this was a threat. This was a threat to not only the state, but it was a threat to church leaders at that time as well. And so we have two groups starting to form. And the two groups are basically were the dissenters or the separists, which would be later known as the Pilgrims, and we're going to talk about them for a while, and the Puritans. Now the separists or the dissenters, they believed that the Church of England was broke. There was nothing they could do to fix it, and we want to start a separate group. We want to base this group on the Bible. We want to take the Bible. We want to start a church based on the Bible, and so we're going to use that. That's what they believed. The Puritans were different. The Puritans were thought, you know what? We're just going to purify the church. That's how they got their name, the Puritans. We're going to purify the church. We're going to leave the Church of England in place, but we just want to purify it, make it more like the Bible. Both the Pilgrims and the Puritans really had the same type of thoughts. They wanted to be more like the New Testament church. They didn't want to be like the establishment they were. They just had two different ways to go about it. Now, the Pilgrims suffered horrible persecutions. Now, if you wanted to change and completely throw out the church structure, not only did it threaten the king, but it threatened the church leaders that were there. They were horribly persecuted. They fled to Holland. And then eventually, in 1620, they decided they were going to come to this new world that was here, that we now live in. And of course, we know they boarded the ship, the Mayflower. It wasn't the first ship they were on. The first ship they had problems, but they ended up boarding the Mayflower and came across. They endured a very hard journey. The Pilgrims were not wealthy people at all. They pretty much pooled their money up and got enough money to buy passage, buy provisions, pay people to sail the ship over. It's interesting to know, when we talk about God's hand in our early American history, here's where we'll start. Interesting to read in history is that they had to hire people that knew how to sail ships, right? They couldn't just, the Pilgrims go out there and sail the ships. They had to hire people. Well, those people started the same tauntings and the same making fun of the Pilgrims as the people that were on the land. In fact, there was one individual that, according to history, was really taking the lead and really just persecuting the Pilgrims. This person took ill and died within a 24-hour period on that ship. And if you read in what happened after that, there were no more taunting of the Pilgrims on that ship after that. Because they believed that this person was being punished by a higher power. That's what they thought. And they did not there. It's interesting to know in the U.S. Capitol, there's a picture, I put it up there on the screen, there's a picture, this is actually in the house side of the Capitol building, in one of the rotundas there, is a huge, I mean it's like 14 by 20 foot painting of the embarkation of the Pilgrims. Now the embarkation of the Pilgrims, as you can see, they're gathered around there, they've got a Bible that's right there in the front of them, they are praying for God's blessing in our journey. It's interesting as we really try, as some groups try to take God completely out of our way we do things in our government, they've got a lot more work to do because the Capitol is full. We could have a whole sermon of just paintings in the Capitol and the religious significance of them. But this is one because it fits our journey that we want to talk about today. They're holding a Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible was printed first in 1560, very similar to the King James text. The Pilgrims, when they came here in 1620 into America, they really spent a lot of time studying the Bible. And you can understand that. You know, we have multiple copies of the Bible. I bet in each of your homes, you have multiple copies, different versions. They didn't have that. And if all of a sudden in your whole life, if you were a 40, 50-year-old person, and all of a sudden you've just got handed your first copy of the Bible, you would spend a lot of time reading it as well. You'd want to know what God wanted you to do. You'd want to know what God's will was. And so they would spend upwards, and some historians say even 4 hours a day, studying the Bible. And they weren't just studying the Bible to check it off their list. They weren't just studying the Bible to, well, I've got to get a chapter in before bed, and they check it off. They were studying the Bible to try to find ways to change their life and make it about biblical principles. And some of the very things that we enjoy today came out of those Bible studies in 1620 to 1630 and that time period in the United States. Or it wasn't the United States yet, in America. Self-government. This idea that people could actually come together and govern themselves. We can choose leaders. They got that from the Bible. They got that from the Bible because that's how the church is structured. The church is supposed to gather together and choose out elders and deacons from among them. They got that. They realized that, hey, that could work for government. And we still enjoy that some 400 years later. Private property. You didn't have private property in Western Europe. They all belonged to the kings. Now, you might have a house and you can live it, and the king would let you live there. But it really, at the end of the day, was the king's property. this private property concept they got from the Bible as well. Taking care of your own. They read James and said, hey, if you can't take care of your own, you're worse than an infidel. They got this concept there. They realized, man, I need to take care of my family. There was no laziness in the Pilgrim colonies in Plymouth Plantation. And the Pilgrims really started the beginnings of the free market system in America. We don't have a lot of time for this, but we had really dive into it. There's a lot of the things that we enjoy today that was started in that column there in 1620 to 1630. The life was very hard for the Pilgrims. God's hand appears to be, and I'll give you the evidence and let everyone be convinced in their own mind, but there's an Indian by the name of Squanto, I don't know if you've heard of that in history, where he gets involved in this. He actually is almost kind of like Joseph-esque in his way he was. He got captured with the Jamestown colony, went to England, and was raised by some monks, and was there and actually learned the Christian religion as well, and was the perfect go-between the Indians and the Pilgrims as they were there. Just happened to be there. Just happened to be trained in both sides, knew the Indian language and the English language, happened to know both religions, how they worked, and was the perfect go-between. And the Pilgrims don't really survive very well if it wasn't for that particular Indian. Was that coincidence or was that the hand of God? I'll let you think that land that. They also landed in the most perfect spot in the area. They landed in the one spot. The Jamestown colony was a disaster. They had very bad relations with the Indians. The Pilgrims landed in the most perfect spot with the friendliest Indians they could have in the whole coastline. Was that the hand of God as well? I don't know. I'll let you decide. The William Bradford was one of the key Pilgrim leaders, and the reason why I bring him up here because he was the cornerstone of what's known as the Mayflower Compact. Now, I have a copy of it. It's not original, in case you're wondering. That would be very expensive. The Mayflower Compact, this was written in 1620. And we all know about the Declaration, right? The Declaration of Independence. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But this is, I would say, in my opinion, this may be the second most important document in our early American history. The Mayflower Compact was, when the Pilgrims came over into America, and I won't take time to read it, if you would like to read some of it later, I have a copy and you can borrow it. The thing is that as we really got into the Pilgrim, the Plymouth Plantation, they had problems. They had issues that were there. They had things that were going on. And William Bradford, the leader, decided, you know what, we need an agreement that we all sign and we all agree to, and it was the founding part of self-government. They all agreed at that point that they would choose their own leaders. They all agreed that they would be together, they would take care of themselves, they would do things the right way, they would follow biblical principles, it's right there in that agreement, and that's the way they were going to live their daily lives. And all these people signed it and they agreed to it. It was probably one of the most significant documents in that thing. It basically was, we don't need a king, we can rule ourselves. That was a big part of this. Now, Pilgrim education, before we go off the Pilgrims and start talking about Puritans for a few minutes, Pilgrim education was a huge deal as well. There was a high illiteracy rate in Western Europe in the late 1500s. And the Pilgrims wanted to make sure that their children could read the Bible. This was a big deal to them. Because you think about it. If we have people that can't understand, that can't read, they don't know if the laws are bad or not. We want to teach our children to read so they can read the Word of God. They can compare the Word of God to the laws that we're passing, and if we ever pass some bad laws, then our children can rise up and they can take care of them. So they created, and I have a copy of this as well, the old Deluder Staten Act from 1647. It's just two paragraphs. It basically was a law that the Pilgrims passed that for every town of 50 or more had to have, by law, someone there that the town paid for to teach the children to read and write. And it says right here in this document that they realized that Satan, the old deluder, wanted, that was one of his plans. They understood what things were happening and how that worked. Is that Satan's plan was to keep everybody illiterate so nobody can read the Word of God and they can't correct their lives. And the Pilgrims were very big on that and they passed that law. Connecticut passed a similar law in the 1690s. There was a $25 fine. I didn't do the math of what $25 would be today, but $25 in 1690, that was a lot of money. That's how serious they took literacy in the early American history, because of the fact they wanted their children to read the Bible. That was the reason why. The Puritans, it's going to take a second, but it's getting there. All right, here we go. The Puritans were, again, back then they wanted to purify the Church of England. They weren't treated quite as badly as the Pilgrims. But however, William Laud was appointed the Bishop of London in the early 1600s, and he made life very hard for them. He made it his personal goal to stamp out the Puritans from the Church of England. And so sure enough, by 1630, about 10 years later when the Pilgrims came over, the Puritans decide to make their way to here. So they decided to leave. They settled in Salem, Massachusetts. Salem is just a little bit north of Boston. The Plymouth Plantation is a little bit south of Boston, just in case you want to have a visual for that. And this is a quote from their leader. "We do not go to England as separates from the Church of England, that we cannot but separate from the corruptions in it, but we go to practice the positive part of church reformation and propagate the gospel in America." That's why the Pilgrims and the Puritans came to America in the first place, was religion. It wasn't because they were trying to make money. That was Jamestown. The Jamestown colony was there because it was businessmen trying to get together thinking, hey, we can find gold in the New World. That's that part. The Puritans and the Pilgrims, they came over simply to flee religious persecution. And it's very difficult to read any of their writings and not come up with that conclusion. They came because they really felt like they needed to have this thing. John Winthrop was their leader. There's a picture of John Winthrop coming up on the screen. In fact, this man would be started the city of Boston. He's credited for founding the city of Boston. One 19th century historian actually said that John Winthrop was the second most influential figure in American history after George Washington. And that's pretty significant for a historian to make that claim. John Winthrop really was very involved in Puritan life, really spent a lot of time making sure that they could do things according to the Bible, they stayed to the Bible, and he really took his role seriously. As you see the quote that's coming up on the screen, he considered that the Puritan way that they were going to start in the New World was a city set upon a hill, that the eyes of all the people are going to be upon us, so that if we deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause Him to withdraw His present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world. This came from a writings, and I have a copy of it, A Model of Christian Charity, written by John Winthrop in the 1630s. This is what he wrote before they came across. It's interesting to know God's hand in the Puritan way of life as well. 1631 in the winter, they were going to run out of food. They were in the colony at that point. They were in Salem. They were about ready to run out of food. And literally, John Winthrop calls the Puritans all together for a day of prayer as they literally, on the day, they were going to run out of food. That same day that they literally used all the food that they had, a ship shows up from England with more supplies that gets them through the winter. Coincidence? I'll leave that with you. These kinds of coincidences, though, happened all the time with the Pilgrims and the Puritans. They would get into a pickle and somehow something would happen. As we get into our U.S. independence, we have this as well. The Puritans were really big about staying together. They took Matthew 12 and 25, that a house or a kingdom divided against itself will fall. They took that very seriously. That was their common thing, that they stay together. Also, we won't go into it too long because I really want to get to a couple other things, but our history has really changed on the Puritans. Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote his book in 1850, The Scarlet Letter, and then, of course, in 1952, Arthur Miller came out with his play, The Crucible, and that forever has changed the public's view of the Puritans. We now view the Puritans and the dark things, the robes, and they're about ready to hit people on the pews that are falling asleep. And that's the way we look at them today because of what our media has really done to that. But really, Puritans, and they were really focused on sin. And the witch trials did happen, and that all happened there in Salem, and we know that was bad. But to put it into perspective, some 100,000 witches every year were put to death in Western Europe. In the period of 1300 to 1800. This was going on across the world. It wasn't just Salem, Massachusetts. The second thing, all as well, is that the Puritans were very concerned about sin. They were very concerned about it. They saw what sin did to England. They saw what sin did to the church there. They knew what it could do, and they were very concerned about that. And they really spent a lot of time making sure that they purified themselves and their colony was pure as well. A repentance happened a lot more times than the discipline that we're often led to believe, but that's the way that we kind of think of things today. There's one thing I will point out before we go into really the Declaration time and the War for Independence, and that is the textbook of that era. Now, this is a small version of it. It's condensed down, something I could carry with me, but this is the New England Primer. The New England Primer was used in our schools from about from 1690, the first 1700, all the way through actually into the early 1900s. This was used to teach our children to read. This was the New England Primer that was used. And it's interesting to use. They go through letters of the alphabet. There's all kinds of things in here. But here's the way they teach letters in the alphabet. A, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. B, heaven to mind, the Bible mind. C, Christ crucified, for sinners died. E, Elijah hid, by ravens fed. These are the examples that were used in our schools to teach our children how to read in that period of time. And we go through all kinds of stuff. There are verses in the Bible used to teach children to read and write. And this was used all the way up into the early 1900s as an elementary school textbook for our children to read. And that would blow a lot of the minds of people today, the fact that this would be used to teach children to read. But this is what happened. And our founding fathers, as we get into that period in the late 1700s, and we'll get there now, we talk about Noah Webster, Benjamin Franklin, Sam Adams, all these great heavyweights of our history, they actually took and reprinted this copy of the textbook because they knew it was important for our children in schools. So our founding fathers, as we get into our war for independence and the Declaration, this is the backdrop of what's going on in history. Okay, by mid-1600s, English flags were almost non-existent in the colonies. They really felt like an independent state already. And so as we get to the 1700s, as the kings really realize that they've not spent any time focusing on America, they've spent on time on France and other things like that, but they haven't spent really any time on the colonies, all of a sudden now that we've got to take control back. And that's when it really didn't work. Charles II demanded that Massachusetts swear allegiance to the crown. Massachusetts very politely, actually if you read their letter back to the king, it was actually very nice, but they refused. And King James, 1684, ordered that the Church of England services be held in the Old South Meeting House in Boston, and that really made it a religious issue. There were a lot of people in the colonies. This is a very important decision there in 1684, because there were a lot of people in the colonies that thought, you know what? The Bible, we're reading the Bible, it says to be subject to the higher powers. It says that we should honor the king. It says we should do that. They read this and they were really having a hard time with, should we tell the king no? Should we really do anything like this independence that they're talking about? But when King James in 1684 ordered that the Church of England services had to be conducted in the American colonies, that really made it a religious battle. And they realized that, you know what, we need to do something about this. We need to be free. And of course it came to the boiling point under King George III. The Intolerable Acts and all that stuff came in there. So we have the question here posed to us this morning, was God on our side? And, you know, there's no Bible verse I can point to that says, you know, God liked the Americans more than the English. There's nothing I can point to there. But let's look at the evidence. Let's look at the evidence that's there, and I'll let you make up your own determination on that. Patrick Henry, of course, was fully convinced that God was on their side. We know the famous quote, "Give me liberty or give me death." That was the famous quote in 1775. But what was before that? We don't learn that today. But what was before that? He said, "There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations and who will raise up friends to fight our battles for us." Patrick Henry was convinced that God wanted the United States of America to happen. You look at Charles Coffin, who's a 19th century historian. He wrote a lot of textbooks that were used in the 19th century, in 1800s, in the United States. He was convinced that you really had to understand that there was a divine hand in the counterattack, because teaching history without teaching God's role in history is just an incomprehensible enigma. That was his quote. So the Declaration of Independence gets here. It's one of the most successful documents in world history. In fact, if you take the Bible out, and you look at documents, maybe the most successful document ever put together. It's based on the book Two Treaties of Government by John Locke, and I have a copy of that book here. This is a reprint, obviously. This was written back in the 1600s. This is the book that our founding fathers based the Declaration of Independence on. One scholar actually went through this Two Treaties of Government and read about it and cites that there are over 1,700 references to the Bible on how to run a government. When you get access to the Bible and you see how it can change your life, this is what happens. John Locke wrote this book. Now, if you listen to those today that are on that are opposed to having any kind of God involved in anything, then you basically hear that John Locke was a deist. He was not. He was an atheist. He was an agnostic. He wasn't really involved in this at all. Well, if he was an atheist or an agnostic, it's kind of odd because he actually authored a topical Bible. He went through and listed all the verses on prayer and love and everything. He actually authored a topical Bible. He wrote a book called The Reasonableness of Christianity because he was so upset at Thomas Paine's book, The Age of Reason. He wrote that book. So it's interesting to note that if he took the time as an agnostic or an atheist to refute those things and write those volumes, that would seem to be ridiculous to make that claim. There are 27 grievances listed in the Declaration of Independence. However, and they're all three that God is referenced about four times in the Declaration. So we know that God was involved. They were thinking about God when they did this. There are 27 grievances. One that we learned today in school is this taxation without representation, because we really have an economic view of history today as opposed to a religious one. That our textbooks are written today to cover that. But there are actually 27 grievances listed in the Declaration, many of which are about the despotism, as they say, of King George at that time. Did we get God's help in the battle of the American Revolution? In 1776, March 1776, we have Boston taken without a shot fired. And amazing thing about it is a mist or a fog covered, wasn't all over through the colony, but a mist or a fog covered up the Continental Army and allowed them to fortify a position. And as they got their things fortified, the mist and the fog subsided. The British realized that they were surrounded. They left Boston without firing a shot. August 1776, the Continental Army is pinned down in New York, and they've got to escape Brooklyn. And they need to get across the river and escape and go through there. And they're going to do a surprise escape at night. So General Washington gets his troops, and they're going to go at night. And it gets to be about daybreak. And they realize they've still got a lot of people to get across the river and to escape. And the people are all concerned. They're going to get found. And if the British see them trying to escape, they have the ability to obliterate them. A fog covers the river and covers their escape for about three more hours that morning in 1776. And as soon as the Continental Army is safe across the river, the fog comes up. January 1781, heavy rains help the Continental Army as they try to cross the Dan River. The British are right behind them. They're just a couple hours behind them. They're way outmanned. They're trying to run. They're fleeing for their lives. They get across the river, and as soon as they're across the river, a storm comes up, and it rains heavily for 2 hours. And by the time the British get to the river, it's impassable. These things happened over and over and over again. Whether it's a storm, a fog, a mist, a tornado in one case, and all kinds of things happened that protected the troops from coming into harm's way. Is God on our side? I'll let you come to that conclusion. A new nation begins. We have a biblical foundation to our Constitution. That's very difficult to be in. We've got when the U.S. defeated the British in Yorktown, we were really a free nation as they went back across. We were no longer under a prohibition to print Bibles in English. That prohibition was no longer there. That was back in the early 1600s. The king at that point said, you know what, you can't print Bibles in English in America. He really wanted to control what was done here. But after we got that there, the king, when we're no longer under that, Congress acted to print the very first Bibles that were printed in America. The United States Congress made a resolution to print Bibles so they could be used in schools. Interesting to know. The University of Houston actually did a study about the Founding Fathers. University of Houston, about back in the 90s, I think, late 80s, early 90s, they did a study. And they went back to the Founding Fathers' books. And they said, you know what? We've got, from 1760 to 1805, we've got a couple thousand writings of the Founding Fathers. And they went back to search. It took them over 10 years to do this. But these people in the city of Houston, they did this thing where they said, you know what? We're going to look at these writings and we're going to find out, where did they get this information? Where did our Founding Fathers get their inspiration? Well, the number one source, more than four times more than the number two source, was the Bible. That's where our Founding Fathers got their inspiration for the things that they did in our country. A Constitution is based on the Bible in a lot of different ways. Isaiah 33 and 22, James Madison brought this up at the Constitutional Convention to say, you know what? It looks like the Lord is our judge, is our lawgiver, and He's our king. You know, that looks like three separate branches. God is the only one that's qualified to have all three of these. There's no man that should have that much power. And so here we go. We're going to use three branches in our United States Constitution. That came from Isaiah 33:22. Ezra 7 and 24 is the basis for tax exemption for churches. Exodus, the 18th chapter, is the basis for the separation of federal, state, local, county government. If you have time and you want to do this on your own, I don't have time today, but look at Article 3, Section 3 of the Constitution and compare it to Deuteronomy 17 and 6. Take the next paragraph and compare it to Ezekiel 18 and 20. And these are just the ones that I mentioned. There's a lot of biblical basis in that. And today, in our textbooks that are written about the founding fathers, we really read about two people. We read about Thomas Jefferson and we read about Benjamin Franklin. Those are our two founding fathers that we really read about. And there's a reason why those are the two that were selected. There's about 250 founding fathers. If you take the Declaration, you take the Constitution, you take those things, there's about 250 founding fathers. Of the 250, those are the two least religious of the 250 men. Thomas Jefferson had a lot of questions, couldn't quite get his hands around miracles, couldn't quite get his hands around a lot of things, and had issues with that. There's a lot of... is that enough buzz, or do I need to do another? Okay, it's okay. Okay. buzzing protocol, I need to make sure that... Okay, all right. But it's interesting to note, and I'm going to talk about just as we wrap up here and get about 5 or 7 minutes more that I'll take, and I promise I'll be done, is I want to take you through a couple of the founding fathers that we don't really read about today, that we don't really get taught today from our textbooks. Benjamin Rush was really known as the father of public schools. This is really that was what his title was, father of public schools. He wrote a famous letter about the use of Bible in schools, and he made a comment that if you ever take the Bible out of schools, then the nation will spend all of its money fighting crime, when you can prevent this right in the classroom. He was a signer of the Declaration, and he didn't really understand how you could ever teach rights and wrongs in a school without use of the Bible. James Wilson was a Pennsylvania man. He's a signer of the Declaration and signer of the Constitution. Only six founding fathers signed both documents, but he was one of the six. He was an active member of the Constitutional Convention. Washington placed him on the first Supreme Court. He was the Supreme Court Justice of the United States. He authored the first legal textbook in America. And his quote really on civil law was, human law must rest its authority ultimately on the authority of what is divine. That was what he said. He didn't understand how you could teach law without using the Bible, because Bible is the basis of law. Bible is the basis of right and wrong. How can you ever have a law school? And he was really influential in that. In fact, he said law and religion are twin sisters. That was his famous quote that he's known for. Law and religion are twin sisters. Fisher Ames. Fisher Ames really authored the First Amendment. If you look back, there were a group of people that were there that did the First Amendment. The First Amendment is what people used to claim that you can't have anything in the public domain that's anything Christian related. And he was worried about adding too many books in the classroom. In fact, Fisher Ames quoted that if you add all these other books into the classroom, you're just going to take away from the Bible. And that didn't make any sense to him. He said, you know what? The best instruction book on morals, language, etc. Is going to be pushed to the back of the curriculum of schools if that's the case. John Jay, the very first Supreme Court justice, made this comment. Leader of the Supreme Court, the Bible is the best of all books, for it's the Word of God, and it teaches us the way to be happy in this world and the next. Noah Webster was a revolutionary soldier in the Revolution. He was a soldier in the Revolution. He was an author, as a judge. Of course, Webster is known for what book? The dictionary, that's right. Noah Webster is known for the dictionary. It was a 20-year project. He dedicated his dictionary to the advancement of the kingdom of God. We have a picture here of the original one. You can actually buy a replication of that original dictionary that he wrote back in 1620. And the dictionary today, Webster's is a public domain today. We could all go together and create a Webster's dictionary if we wanted to. It's in the public domain. But the original dictionary, this is the preface to the original dictionary that was there. It said, basically, in my view, the Christian religion is the most important and one of the first things which all children under free government ought to be instructed. I like that. I thought that was pretty cool. My slides are going a little slow. In closing, because I need to wrap up so we can go on with the rest of our service this morning, but I have a slide that entitles, say, why is this all important? Why do we need to study this? Why do we need to talk about it? Why is it that this needs to be discussed today? Is this a U.S. history class? Are we here to discuss? Do you all know more about U.S. history than you did before? Is that the reason why we're there? No. The reason why we're here is because when you base anything on biblical principles, whether it be a country, whether it be a church, whether it be your life, whether it be any kind of your business, when you base it on biblical principles, your chances of success go up hundredfold. And I have a really an analogy here. If you look at the French Revolution that happened the same time as the U.S. Revolution, U.S. Revolution happened in the mid-1700s. The French Revolution happened in the late 1700s, 1792, 93, in that range there. Both of them were about some of the similar things. But however, the U.S. Revolution was about religion. It was about freedom of speech. It was about freedom to worship the way we want. The French Revolution was about enlightenment. It was very heavily influenced by The Age of Reason by Thomas Paine, which is a very anti-Christian book. They were very hesitant about it. And what was the result? Let history be the judge. What was the result of the American Revolution, and what was the result of the French Revolution? The American Revolution created was a monumental success. The other created absolute a reign of terror in the world that is almost unrivaled, with Napoleon becoming to power there in the early 1800s in France. And so it's interesting to note here that biblical principles create success. And I really struggled as I got into a lot of American history, and I really got excited about the sermon and ready to go. I thought, you know, what's my theme? What's my point? How am I going to bring this all together and make it relevant for everybody today? Other than maybe you out there are not really interested in history. Maybe you don't really, not that big a deal to you. But the thing is, the lesson that we can learn here today is that biblical principles create success. We know that in our church. We believe strongly at the Church of Christ that we should base everything we do in church service and in practice on the Bible. That's what we believe strongly. But I think that it's more than that. I think when we base our country, our government, when we base everything we have on the principles of Christianity, we have a lot bigger chance of success. And it's the same thing with your life. If you take the same biblical principles and you read the Bible and you apply it to your life, your chances of success go up big time. And history proves that. And I didn't answer the question whether I believe that God was involved in everything. I'll let you make that determination yourself. But after having such a wonderful country that we live in, after having all the wonderful things that we have in this country, I think the only thing we can do is just simply tell God thank you. Tell God thank you for all the blessings that He's given and He's shed on this wonderful United States of America. God has blessed us more than we can ever imagine, and we owe Him a debt of gratitude for His blessings on our country. Thank you.